This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper an award-winning author. She was here before to talk about a wonderful book that she won many awards for, and that is The Lines Between Us. And now Rebecca Deharang is back, and we are talking about a book that not only is going, I'm sure, going to be an award-winning book, it is a thrilling book. I am so happy to welcome you back, Rebecca. The Map Colorist is a fantastic book.
Well, thank you, Patsy. It's very nice to be here.
You know, of course, I loved The Lines Between Us. I thought that was just superb. But this one, because of the connections to Holland, to all of this, to maps, because I love maps. I have a trunk full of maps.
Oh, where, my.
Wherever I go, I have collected a map or two, or sometimes my husband would say, "You really don't need a dozen maps of Paris." And I'd say, "Well, darling, each one gives me a little bit."
There you go.
And that's it. Exactly. And so I love maps. And when I got this, the minute I got the book, you were so kind to send it to me, and I saw it, I saw the cover. And, of course, I also love Holland. I'll let you set the scene, because so many people do not understand the importance of Holland, or what is called the Netherlands, to the development of the world, because they were at the forefront of discovery. So you must have been really excited when you got the idea to write a book about the map making that they were doing. The Dutch traveled all over the world. They were great explorers, and they all wanted maps.
Yes, that's very true. Yeah, and I kind of actually stumbled on to Amsterdam because I knew I wanted to stay in the 17th century. My first book was in the 17th century, and I decided I wanted to have a woman who did something unusual, and for some reason I thought, cartography! And I thought I would be staying in Spain because I thought surely they would be big on map making. But I discovered that, no, Amsterdam was actually the capital of map making of the world at that time. And as you said, Patsy, it's because they were doing a lot of exploring and trading. I mean, it's largely because of the success, the enormous success of the Dutch East Indies and Dutch West Indies, India companies that, they were all over the world. They were traders with everyone, and it was an amazing success story. And also they were, it was the Dutch Republic. They had just recently, at the time of my book in 1660 and 1648, they had finally finished with the war of Spain, which had lasted off and on for 80 years. So it's an exciting time and place there.
And then you came across the Atlas Major.
Yes.
I mean, that must have, like, your heart must have stopped if you didn't know about it before. When you discovered that, it was like, oh, this is unbelievable.
Yeah, it was. The Atlas Major was the major, was like the largest publication of the century, of the 17th century. And in different languages, the different language editions are different numbers of volumes, but they're around 9 volumes for most of them, and they're huge books. And people who purchased them, who were, of course, quite wealthy, had specific cases made for them to store the Atlas Major. And as I bought sort of the modern abridged version. And in reading the introduction, I learned that women and children sometimes colored maps at home for not very much pay, because, of course, they were just printed in black and white. And for people who wanted something a little bit more, who could afford something a little bit more, they would pay for a colored map.
and they paid. Now, when you came across this, as you said, it's really the Atlas Major, but I know that people tend to say major, but it is the Atlas Major, and it is quite amazing. I mean, there were so many maps, I think about 964 or something like that, and over 3,000 pages of text. So this was a major work, and of course purchased by rich people, but the individual maps also made their way over the years into commerce, because this is how traveling was done. This is how people went out there and traveled the world and took that risk of, partly because of what the Dutch had done, of course the British too, but the Dutch were really, they were so great at cartography. So why don't you sort of set the scene for us and explain also about map making and cartography and the importance of it and how the Dutch were just so good at it.
Okay, sure. And of course also having the sea maps, the Portolan maps, was also very important for the voyages. And it's interesting that the maps were not all terribly current. So when Johan Blau, who was the publisher of the Atlas Major, published his huge production, a lot of the maps were decades old, and that's how it was often done. So he used old maps that he had. Publishers would often sort of, not to say steal, but appropriate maps of their competitors, because there were several large cartographers, map publishing companies at the time, and so it was sort of interesting to me that they didn't all have to be new, and so that sort of set the scene for my book. Well, here this person is going to offer something new. Surely Johan Blau would be interested in something new. And it's also the Dutch East India Company also had their own cartographers and their own maps, some of which they tried to keep secret. But as it happened, Johan Blau at one point was the official cartographer for the Dutch East India Company. So, you know, he had a little access, perhaps.
So creating a map depended, most people don't sort of understand the process of creating a map. They think, like, the explorer goes to a country, he sees it, and he draws a map. But that's not the way it's done.
No, it's not. So, you know, there would have to be surveying done, very specific notes taken. And that's what happens in my book. And you would add on to what people had done before. You were sort of filling in, because we've all seen those old maps where there would be huge blank areas, particularly in Africa, which is the area that I'm talking about in the book, where they would just draw things in. They would draw in animals or sometimes fantastic creatures, you know, or people. They just put them in an empty space until somebody later came along and said, well, here, actually, these are some specific places that we can put on the map. So it was a slow process to develop the map.
So you've created a character, a woman, which, of course, you know, those days, and women were not known to be the ones doing this kind of work. But cartography, the cartographers would measure things. They would have detailed numbers. They would have elevations. They would have distances. They would have all of this information. And then somebody had to put this on paper. And this was a great talent.
Yes, and as you said earlier, it wasn't the people usually who were exploring who actually drew the map. They got the data and then would bring them to our cartographer, who knew how to translate that data into a pictorial view of the land. So, yeah, it was a very specific talent. And there were, as in my book, there were schools in Amsterdam and Leiden that taught surveying and cartography. And surveying was really important then, too, because of the different Waterschloppen, which were the boards that would regulate water and polders and how the water was drained off of certain areas or not drained off. And so there was a large demand for that kind of work.
And so now you created a character, a wonderful, very well-drawn and fascinating character, a young woman who was a map colorist. And that was a different talent, but she was doing something very special here. So tell us about her character and how you came out with her.
Okay, so she from a young age, her mother taught her to be a map colorist.
And her name, let's start with her name and her family.
Name is Annika van Broek, and her mother taught her and her brother, Lucas, how to color a map. And her father happens to be an artist, not a terribly successful artist, but he's an artist. And as she's coloring the maps, her talent at it becomes apparent to people at the House of Blau, which is where they're coloring for the House of Blau. And she is brought into the house to actually color at the publishing house so they could sort of mentor her. And then one of Blau's clients wants a colorist, and so she goes to his house to work. But she has also dreamt almost all of her life since her father told her stories when she was a little girl of his trip to Africa. And her father had sent her brother Lucas, had sort of said, okay, enough map coloring, I'm going to send you to school to learn surveying and cartography. And she, of course, wouldn't have been eligible to go to that school, but she would read her brother's books, his notes, and convince her mother, who then convinced the father that, oh, the brother needed a tutor, and then she would sit on the tutoring classes. So that's, I had to do sort of a workaround for how she would have possibly gotten the talent and the knowledge, the very specific knowledge to draw a map.
Well, I love how you do it. And it's the mother's name is Elizabeth, and it would just be natural because the work was done at home so often, although they had a studio, but Elizabeth did most of her work at home, and it would be just natural that when she has little kids, they would start coloring. It would be, it was just the way you tell the story about how, as children, they start just gradually, little by little, learning how to color a map. And of course, for Annika, it becomes a real passion. And of course, Lucas wants a little bit more excitement in his life.
Yes, and you know, the lure of joining the Dutch East India Company or Dutch West India Company was always there for young men, and it was extremely difficult voyages they would go on, and a lot of the crew would die. But he's nevertheless, ever since he started seeing all these maps, was wondering about, well, what about the people who live there? And so at one point he does quietly, without telling his parents until 2 days before he is going to leave, signs up on a Dutch West India boat, because it would be a somewhat shorter journey than on the Dutch East India boat. So.
And it is true. I mean, even today, you know, when you think of India, you think, of course, of the British colonists, but the Dutch were so active there, all across all of that area. You know,
yeah, they were really big in what's now Indonesia. Batavia, which is what we call now Jakarta, was kind of one of their main places. But they had, of course, we know they even were in the Americas, in New Amsterdam.
Uh-huh.
And they had, for not very long, a colony in Brazil. They were, you know, and it was not, let's not paint a totally wonderful picture of what they did, because they were heavily involved in the slave trade also. So, and in places where they colonized, like in the current Indonesia, they coerced indigenous people
to
work with them. So,
well,
yeah, they were very prosperous, but at the expense of other people.
But they were a very prosperous nation at the time, and certainly in the 1600s, they were a major power.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. The Dutch East India Company, the Dutch West India Company, were also allowed by the government to basically wage war. So They were very powerful. The companies were very powerful.
Now, this must have been really, as I said, it must have been so much fun just to come across it. The whole process of maps, I love, as I said, I love maps. My favorite class when I was in elementary school was geography, which I think is such a great subject, and they don't teach it anymore. But
yeah.
I was raised in northern Michigan, so we were behind the times, to put it mildly. Everything came to northern Michigan 10 years later than every place else. Television, I mean, everything. You know, we just, and we were still using books from the 50s, I think. And one of our classes was geography, and I remember the thrill. Because I was reading at such a young age, I mean, I was already reading Perry Mason mysteries when I was five. So, you know, you can imagine that school was pretty boring for me, except that moment. You know, in the old days, how at the front of the room they'd have this map on a roller, and like a window shade, and they'd pull it down. And I mean, I came alive for that that class, that lesson, because it was magic. It was just magic to see the map and to wonder, like the people here in this book, they look at the maps and they see these drawings that went along with the maps, and you wonder what's out there. I want to see it. I want to see it.
Yeah.
So I love geography, and that's why I think this book will resonate so much with people. They love to imagine other places.
That's true. Yeah, I liked geography too. And although map making was not my forte, you know, we'd have the standardized test, and our whole class would always do really poorly on map reading. So it's a little ironic that I wrote a book about map making.
Well, I like we were given mimeographed sheets of map, you know, countries, and then we could color them ourselves.
Uh-huh.
And I remember I was very good at that. I would always the teacher would always say, "Oh, Patsy, it's so good."
Because maybe you were a map colorist.
I could have been, probably, if I had lived in those days. Now, did you ever discover, were there female map colorists?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yes, women and children would color maps in the home, because and they didn't get paid very much. And these were really maps only that, you know, sort of middle-class burghers could afford. So they couldn't be paid much, because the publisher wasn't going to charge very much for them. But yes, it was definitely women, and as I say, even children would color maps. And then, of course, there were the much more skilled map colorists. In the book, they're mentioned Van Stanton. He was famous even in his own time for making beautiful maps, and people still collect his maps.
Well, and I love the drawings, and you particularly mentioned the one, as you said, her father had traveled to Africa, so he came back with stories, and he came back with, you know, telling them about exotic creatures that they didn't see in Amsterdam. And it was funny when you write about that there was actually an elephant in Amsterdam.
Yes, there was. Hanskin was an elephant that was brought to Amsterdam, and I think in the 1940s, and Rembrandt was entranced and apparently made many, many drawings of Hanskin. Hanskin was an Indian elephant.
So it's funny, you know, when we look back at it now, and people didn't know so much, you know, didn't know about all of the countries and about all of the animals. But it's, even today, they're finding, suddenly, they just recently found a little country in the middle of nowhere. And I love that. I love that,
yes.
You know, there's always discoveries to be made.
Yeah.
But this book, it's also a love story, and it's a story, I think, I love the mother-daughter relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That's very touching.
Thank you.
Elizabeth
is a complex character. Hopefully they're all complex. But yes, she loves her children so much, and her relationship with her husband is, she loves him, but there's also some disappointment there, because as he's disappointed in himself. He has high aspirations of being an artist, and he is an artist, but you know, there was a lot of competition at that time and place.
Yeah, when you've got Rembrandt around the corner, it's real, it's real hard to compete when you know, that, when you have that. But you write a lovely story here about a family and with their ups and downs, but there is this love that permeates the family, and I think that Anika is a character that, you know, so many young people will relate to. I think that her passion, wanting to do something, and then working hard, I think she's a great example for people to say, yeah, you know, people might say, you can't be a colorist, or you can't do that, or you can't make a map, in her case. But you can if you work hard.
Yes, and she makes some compromises, does, you know, some things that are a little questionable, but, you know, sometimes that's what people have to do to succeed, and we sort of forgive her, I think.
I think so, because you've written a really lovely book. I think it's delightful. It just reads so well. The characters are great. The story, I always love to come away from a book knowing more, and people definitely will. They will enjoy this book. And I hope that, well, I know that you're going to be an award winner, and I just wanted to mention again that, you know, your last book, you won a lot of awards for that finally, huh?
Yeah, it did pretty well, yeah.
Yeah, well, I would think so. National Indie Excellence Award. I can't go through them all, but I do like the, which one was it I thought was impressive? Well, they're all impressive. Independent Press Award. You know, so you've won a lot of awards, and I think that's great, and I'm sure this one will too, because it is just a fine book, and I just enjoy your writing so much.
Oh, thank you, Patsy. I appreciate that.
So do you have a website you want people to go to?
Yes, they can go to my website. It's Rebecca DeHarling, RebeccaDeHarlingGue.com.
DeHarling. It has the UE at the end, so people...
Yeah, it's a little tricky there.
little tricky, DeHarling. It's a beautiful name. And what are you working on now?
My next book is going to, I really liked the, you know, 1660-ish Amsterdam, so I'm going to stay there, but the next book's going to, I'm going to try my hand at a mystery, so we'll see how that goes.
Okay. Well, it is an interesting period. I spent a lot of time in Amsterdam. And I really, I love the country. It is just a beautiful place. And I think you will, there's so many, of course, you have the Tulip Wars, just.
Yes, there's so many fascinating things that happened in the 17th century. Yes.
Absolutely. And because people don't realize, you know, having lived in Michigan, you know, coming from Michigan, one of the things that we used to do every year is go to the Tulip Festival in Holland, Michigan.
And my mother,
that was my mother's favorite flower, and we planted that every fall. People don't realize you have to put the bulbs in.
Yes.
Somebody once said, well, that they wanted to plant tulip, and I said, well, yeah, but you better wait till October. So, you know, people don't. But they were once very valuable. And,
their fortunes on them, buying a particular tulip, yes.
Oh, yeah. So I have a feeling you're going to have a lot of fun with the next book.
I hope so.
Well, I think it's so wonderful that exactly when did you start writing?
Oh, well, I started in 1994, but then gave up for about 20 years.
So you gave up, but then you came back to it, and you come back to it really strong, I can tell you, really strong, as an award-winning author, and it's a joy to talk to you again. Thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. The name of the book is A Map Colorist. It's available online. You will love this book. It's really a lot of fun, and... Rebecca, thank you again for being on Joy on Paper.
Oh, thank you so much, Patsy. I've really enjoyed it.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye.
All right. We're going to play a book buzz, a very special one for a very special lady. And then I'll be back after the commercials.
Hello, fellow mystery lovers. This is author Rita Moreau reporting for Joy on Paper with a mystery that will keep you turning the pages. Carol J. Perry's Now You See It. Sometimes 13 is a lucky number, and for fans of Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mystery series, it is, with this latest installment that features Lee Barrett, the program director for Salem, Massachusetts, local station WICH-TV. In Now You See It, Lee and her husband, Detective Sergeant Pete Mondello, are settling into their new home. The honeymoon is over, and Lee is back on the job as program director for Salem's WICH-TV, recently promoted to historical documentary chief executive. Her first project is to promote Salem's new international museum. Seems easy enough. She loves looking at their collection and doing research about Salem's long-ago days as a shipping capital. That is until the driver of a truckload of antiquities turns up dead. Soon, Lee and Pete are dredging up clues along with a hearty crew of helpers. Aunt Ibby, a former librarian, offers her advice, while a local practicing witch, River North, has some ideas too. And of course, Orion, Lee's clairvoyant cat, has his own ideas. But when a ship motto in the exhibit's collection appears to be haunted, Lee will have to dive into her own treasure trove of psychic gifts. For author Carol J. Perry, juggling details and coming out with twisty plots is her specialty. After all, she was born on Halloween Eve in Salem. Special thanks to Kensington Publishing for another great cozy mystery. Pre-order Now You See It by Carol J. Perry and expect the unexpected in a mystery that features a memorable cast of characters and lots of page-turning fun. This book will be released on September 26, 2023. Now You See It! Book number 13 in Carol J. Perry's Witch City Mystery Series is available online. This is Rita Moreau, author of the Ghost and Camper Cookie Mystery Series, reporting for Joy on Paper. For more of my suggestions, go to our website, www.radio-joyonpaper.com. Buzzing off for now.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida, can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest and with a very interesting book. I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Carolyn McBride, and the name of her book is Four Seasons at Cutler's, A Year to Choose the One. Oh, boy, the one. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Patsy. It's so great to meet you and be on your show.
Oh, this is fun. This is going to be fun. I love it. You know, there are so many reasons I enjoyed this book. One, I was raised in a family Italian restaurant, and I have stirred more pots of spaghetti sauce than you can imagine.
Wow, I had no idea.
So I love anything about an Italian family restaurant. And then I worked for Hotel Intercontinental. And so I love the hotel side too. So you have everything in this book and then all the places. It's just lots of fun.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. It's meant to be escapism, armchair travel. It's very lighthearted and fun, and it takes you on an adventure around the world to 20 different cities, each city having their own personalities and own highlights. So it's a joy to write. I only write about cities that I've been to, so that's special too.
Yeah, well, I had a feeling you've been to them. There are so many, quite a few, of course. Most of them I have been to, the cities actually, except Dubai, because they wouldn't want me there. And sometimes you're picking my favorite restaurant or my favorite hotel. So when you go to Miami and you go to the Delano, I mean that.
It's a classic.
It's my go-to place. I mean, I love it. The first time I remember we walked in there and I said, oh my God, I'm not going to leave. Leave me here.
I know the feeling. I love it. That's why I had to include it in the book.
Well, I could tell that every place that you write about, you've been and you've had fun there. And I must say, because I lived in Houston for too many years, the Houston part cracked me up.
Well, I really wanted to contrast Houston to New York and two different restaurant groups with, you know, a different work style. So you have the Italian, super charismatic, outgoing extroverts in New York. And then you go down to Houston, and it's a little more serious, but they're gracious, and they're kind, they're good Southern people, so there were benefits to each side.
Exactly, there are definitely. So tell us about Charlotte, and tell us, I'm so glad, this dating world, you make it a lot of fun to read about.
Right. Well, there's a lot of dating in this book. So Charlotte McPherson is a restaurant publicist in her late 30s in New York City. And Four Seasons at Cutler's is actually part of the series. Four Seasons at Angelino's is the first book in the series. However, you do not have to read that book to catch on to the story at Four Seasons at Cutler's. But in it, there's actually a love triangle between Charlotte's love of her life, Wyatt Ashcroft, who's this elusive Hollywood producer who's out to save the world one film at a time, and then her new boss, Travis Cutler, who's a Southern gentleman from Houston.
Yeah.
And
you're
Travis
calling it, you're calling, now you're calling it, or your publicist, oh, you're the publicist for your publicist?
I don't I mean, I have a great publicist, actually.
I mean, you're a publicist, but you needed to hire a publicist to tell us that you are writing about a neurodivergent love triangle. Now, I had never heard of a neurodivergent, but I got a kick out of that. I thought, oh, boy.
Well, Patsy, let me tell you, these days, more and more people are on the spectrum. And even Elon Musk, during his Saturday Night Live appearance, mentioned that he has Asperger's. I think that the stigma is going away, and it's a reality. People are on the spectrum, men and women. Women tend to hide it more than men. And so out there in the dating world, a lot of women are trying to understand, like, is he not into me? Is he on the spectrum? Is there something else going on? And in the case of Four Seasons at Cutler's, Wyatt Ashcroft, the film producer, yeah, he's such a genius. He is somewhat on the spectrum. And, this is a romantic comedy, so we don't go too deep into medical diagnosis. But Charlotte, realizing that she still loves him, it doesn't change her feelings at all. She just wants to learn how to communicate with him more accurately, or more effectively, I should say. Because in the end, relationships are all about communication.
It was funny, as I was reading this, because I'm deeply into Charlotte Bronte, I kept thinking to myself, oh, what would Charlotte Bronte think about dating these days?
Oh, my goodness. It's changed quite a bit, I must say, with online dating and matchmakers. And, yeah, it's a whole nother world.
it would be so funny. Actually, I should write a book about Charlotte Bronte coming back. He did discover that.
That would be great.
Maybe I'll do that.
I think you should. I think it would be fascinating because it's just changed so much and it constantly evolves. You have new terms like, well, ghosting has been around for a while, and you know they keep coming up with new things. It's tough because it's gone, to tech. So you meet people online and they look good on paper, but then there's like five other guys in the queue and you're like, So people start getting more and more picky. And then in the end, they don't end up meeting in person, or when they do, they're disappointed because the person doesn't look like their pictures and they don't match their profile, or they lied about their age or whatever it may be. It's really a struggle out there in the trenches.
It really is, because it was only like a year or so ago, an author came to me with a book called Red Flags, and I thought she was writing about communists in the 1950s. And it took me a while to realize she's telling me, you know, this is really it's an important subject. You really have to understand the red flags. There are these red flags you have to know about. And I had no idea what it was. I discovered after that it had something to do with dating.
It's true. I mean, and there's the question of chivalry. Like, you know, does the man still open the door for the woman? And some men, they just don't know what to do because they think they might offend the woman by opening the door and insinuating that she can't do it herself. So, you know, I do feel for both men and women and, you know, whatever people are into, because there's just a lot of complications and mixed signals and opportunity for misunderstanding.
And of course, you have also some, you know, this some of the serious side that she's not young, so she's
right. So that's part of the story too, because women in their 30s, they've worked so hard on their careers, and some of them who find themselves unmarried, they start questioning: did they put too much time in work, or what went wrong? And then there can be a feeling of desperation where they're really trying to nail down a guy and find the one. And that again brings us back to Four Seasons at Cutler's, where Travis Cutler is sort of the safer bet because he's traditional Southern and wants the family, but her heart really is with Wyatt Ashcroft, who is based in LA and busy making films, traveling around the world doing that.
Yeah, and wants to save the world and be eco-friendly and not eat red meat.
I love that.
And it actually, when the Houston part, when you're talking about the steaks, I must say, I do like steak.
So. Yes, and I do too, and so does our protagonist. Charlotte is a meat eater, and she does drink martinis in New York, but Wyatt doesn't eat meat because it's bad for the environment, and he doesn't drink alcohol because he's just so laser focused. So there is some personality clashes. And again, that makes the Texan much more easy for her because she can just devour those steaks and throw back the the booze and not feel judged or inadequate.
Yeah. I think it was a martinis. I'm sort of on the side of the martini myself.
But I think it's great you live in Houston. I was there for the Super Bowl when they hosted it, and just such a great town, great city. I write a travel blog, so every city that's featured in the book, there's a travel blog entry with the best restaurants and recommendations. Like in Houston, you have NASA Space Museum, and I give all the different points of interest that people should check out when they visit each city.
So the when you, because you're a publicist, and you publicize hotels, so you really know what it's like to get into a hotel and be welcomed.
Oh, for sure. I mean, hospitality, making the guest feel like they're the king or queen is so important. Also, friendliness, I think, is also important as well. So, yeah, I've stayed all different from 5-star and below. So I've experienced it all. And I just think that when you travel somewhere, where you stay and where you eat is paramount to having a great experience.
Well, tell us a few of your favorite restaurants that you mentioned here. Of course, you know, it's and let's people can then get the book and see if they're going to go to these restaurants or if they find some new ones.
Oh, absolutely. Well, first of all, I should definitely give a shout out to Serafina, which is based in New York. And I worked with them for over a decade as their in-house publicist and business development director. And so they're based in New York, but there's locations in Boston, Miami, other places around the world like Dubai. And that's what was so important in the book. I was blessed to be able to open restaurants around the world. So when you see a chapter like Dubai, I actually went there twice and worked there to establish the brand and help the team out. So Serafina, whenever you're in New York, it's a good family restaurant too, or it could be a good date night. It's casual Italian. It's fantastic. For more upscale Italian in New York, I always recommend Cipriani, which also has outposts in Mexico City and Miami and other and LA. I am now based in LA, and we have a fantastic Greek restaurant, Avra. Greek food is Greek, any kind of Mediterranean food, amazing. I love Avra. Here in LA, we have Mr. Chow for Chinese, the Ivy, which is kind of iconic here on Robertson, and so many great choices. Well, I mean, depends on the food. Like,
yeah.
Do you want
well, now
sushi?
You're making everybody hungry, and everybody will want to go to one of these, well, a lot of these cities, and most of them are very accessible. People can go to Las Vegas easily enough, but Miami, but also Florence is on your list, and I love Florence.
Oh, yes. So what I do is I try in my books to mix it up, and obviously America is the base, but I always want a few European destinations, and then, this time I delved into the Middle East with Dubai, and we have Mexico City also, and Toronto for our friends up north. Definitely try to include as many cities as possible and obviously incorporate the restaurants. In the case of Florence, it was part of a romantic getaway stemming from Cannes because Europe is drivable, and that's what's so amazing, to be able to drive a few hours, you're in another country. And so Wyatt and Charlotte take off to Florence and have a very romantic few days there before they head over to Sirmione, which is in the lake region. So what I also try to do is throw in a city that a lot of people haven't heard of. So the first book was Capistel, which is it's an amazing, amazing hotel property in the south of France. So romantic. And, I had a great time there. It was the wrong guy, but it was a great place. And so I put that in the first book. And then this time I put Sirmione. I also always include a ski resort destination. So the first book was Aspen. And then this one, Four Seasons at Cutler's, has a chapter on Park City, Utah, which is one of my all-time favorite places as well.
Well, you are living an enchanted life, and you're putting it down on paper and giving people this absolute wonderful ability to do some armchair traveling and, of course, get very hungry for good food.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you. I'm trying to whet everybody's appetite and then just give them a good time and have some fun and escape through a book.
Well, that is... You know, that is so important. I know that we have to pay attention to the news. We have to pay attention to what's going on in the world. We have to be sort of like Charlotte's boyfriend. We do need these moments of escape. We just need to smile. Just need to sort of forget for a little while all the problems, and we do have so many problems. But I think that's what books do, and you certainly do, you do it in spades here with all of this, because it is lots of fun to read.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I feel like you said, there's so much trials and tribulations in this world and so many bad things going on, but there's also so much beauty. So to be able to highlight beautiful places and experiences in a book, it's such a pleasure. It's a joy, like you say, joy on paper.
Exactly. And you are very observant. I love some of your comments, some of your descriptions of people and things they say. You capture dialogue very nicely. So it does definitely put a smile on your face. Now, of course, we had four seasons. Angelina, so you're working on the next four seasons?
Yes, there will be a third book. And also, I want to say with Four Seasons at Cutler's, we have an audiobook version. And the male narrator is fantastic. He was on The Sopranos, Andy Davoli. He's just got a great voice, and he hits those accents, the New York accent, Italian, Houston, even Australian. So the audiobook was a lot of fun, too. And then the third book, we'll see when it comes out.
Okay.
The story will continue.
The story continues. Well, I think it's just a lot of fun. And it's available online, and I'm sure you're available online with your website and social media and all that stuff.
Absolutely. CarolineMcBride.com and Four Seasons at Cutler's is available at Barnes & Noble and Amazon.
Exactly, and I'm sure that people, you will enjoy it. It's just a fun read. It's lighthearted and with a little bit of, you know, serious commentary on social, on society's abnormalities, we could say. But definitely, it's a fun read. And again, thank you, Carolyn, for being on Joy on Paper. I think you're just my kind of person, because you enjoy traveling like I did when I worked for the hotel and also an Italian restaurant. So again, Four Seasons at Cutler's. Get it today, and people, just chill out for a little while.
Thank you so much, Patsy. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, it's been a joy to talk to you.
Thank you. Likewise.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. She's so cute. You know, sometimes you just need a book like this. Just, oh, gosh. I as I said, I was listing how many, well, I think I've been to all the cities. As I said, I can't go to Dubai. But other than that, I've been to all of the cities, actually. I've been to all of the cities. And among my favorite was Toronto, which is really a food city. Wonderful restaurants in Toronto. People don't realize that. You can go to Toronto and eat. They have streets and streets of restaurants. It's really lots of fun to go to Toronto. Almost bought a hotel there once, and a lot of other wonderful places. So this is a way to travel, a way to learn about cities and about people, and I'm looking forward to that. Audible sounds fun. I love when they are able to talk in different accents. Okay, well, today is also a very special day. Today was the release date of Douglas Brunt's wonderful, wonderful book about Rudolf Diesel. I do hope you'll get it. I'm sure that it's going to be a bestseller. I hope it's going to be a instant bestseller, to hit right to the top today, because it is also, you know, and it's funny, it's also an important book. Every few days you go to the gas station, and you put in your gas and you see the word diesel and you think about it, you heard the word. Most people don't know that Diesel was a person, a real person. Rudolf Diesel was a brilliant inventor, a brilliant man, and a very important man in history, and somebody who everybody just forgot, because in a way, he just disappeared. He disappeared one night.
September 29th, 1913, on the eve of World War I. He took a ship from Antwerp. He was going to England. And somewhere between Antwerp and before the ship landed in England, he disappeared. It was really one of the biggest mysteries of all time because he was very important. Just like Elon Musk today, if Elon Musk suddenly disappeared, everyone would go crazy. Well, that's what happened with Rudolf Diesel. He just disappeared. They found his room all nicely organized, his pajamas laid out, everything looking very neat and organized. They found his coat folded, and they didn't find him. He was gone. So, of course, immediately in those days, it was by telegraph, the world discovered that Rudolf Diesel, the inventor of the diesel motor, which in effect changed the world because his motor took over all motors. I mean, that was it. After that, that the idea of steam ships, where if you've seen the movie Titanic, where you see them shoveling coal into a furnace to make steam to move the ship, that was over with because of diesel. He created this engine. And when he disappeared, nobody knew what happened to him. And Doug Brunt discovered right, really, by accident, the story of Diesel, because he bought an old boat and he converted it from gasoline to diesel engine. And that is what got him interested. And that's what I'm talking about, the joy of paper. Sometimes you'll get an idea, you'll think about something, and then if you're clever and if you work hard, and Doug Brunt took 5 years to research this to find out what happened to Rudolf Diesel. So he's written this nonfiction book called Rudolf Diesel, but it is so wonderful. It reads like a thriller. It reads just like a modern thriller because you don't know what happened to Rudolf Diesel. There were people who wanted him dead, including the German Kaiser, but also people like John D. Rockefeller and other oil people who were terrified of what his diesel engine would do to their money. Because if people didn't need gasoline engines, well, what would happen to them? So Doug Brunt's Rudolf Diesel is released today. Get it. It's really worth it, and it's a wonderful read. And that's what I call, and that's why I always tell you, remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know. I am sure Doug Brunt's will become a streaming video hit. It's going to be a major mini-series because Rudolf Diesel is fascinating. And say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. Everybody, have a wonderful, wonderful day. And on Thursday, Bill Larson will be here. Send in your questions. And Big Ed saluted me. I have to salute him. And everybody, bye-bye now.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.